You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM, WVUDN, WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you August 4th, 2013, from our studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Ahead this hour, Persephone and I discuss political concepts of legitimacy and the theories related to that in light of the crisis in Egypt, and we talk about what the city of Boston is doing to prepare for the effects of climate change. All this is just ahead on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday afternoon and is available for download on Monday nights or Tuesday mornings at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Welcome to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio is my co-host Persephone. How are you doing, Persephone?
Pretty good, thanks.
This week we're going to start off with a discussion of legitimacy in government that was brought on kind of by some discussions we were having related to the events in Egypt. There's kind of been this debate about, is it a coup? Is it undemocratic? Was the previous government there, the Morsi government, democratic? If it was a democratically elected, majoritarian president, but there was no legislature because that had been suspended by the courts. And there was some concerns about not respecting minority rights in the country. And, you know, what is a democracy? How is that defined? And now what gives the army legitimacy to rule or not? Is it just, you know, is it just ruling by force? Because arguably you can kind of break down from a macro standpoint, you can break down governance into rule by legitimacy and rule by force. And usually rule by force, that's pretty self-explanatory, that someone has the right to rule you because they can, as opposed to rule by legitimacy, which is what we're going to talk about, which is some other explanation for why the people in charge are allowed to be in charge in a governmental system, whether it's democratic or not democratic. And that's the legitimacy is the alternative to ruling by just might, you know, that you have the power to rule, so therefore you do. It's more of an abstract concept. And in particular, this was kind of brought up because of July 24th or thereabouts, there was a New York Times article about General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who is the defense minister. He's a slightly younger general than some of the older leadership that had been in power in the military before, but not that young. And he is sort of de facto running the country because he was the person who overthrew the Morsi government. And now he installed a transitional president and other transitional figures who are civil leaders, a prime minister and so forth. And they're the ones who are supposedly running the country, but effectively he's the one who's pulling the strings. And that's not really that big of a surprise given the overwhelming, powerful role of the Egyptian military in the society. I mean, besides the sort of general popularity of the military, which gives it some power, is the source of some of its power, and we'll get into that. There is just the fact that they do control most of the business and the economy in the country. Any large business contracts are generally through the military. That was sort of set up over many decades under the Mubarak government and the previous governments before that, which were also military-aligned governments in Egypt. And so General al-Sisi called for mass protests, which, again, I mean, normally you would have a general trying to shut down mass protests, not the other way around, that the mass protests would be against a general or something like that. In this case, he said, according to the New York Times article, he asked Egyptians on that day to hold mass demonstrations that would give him a, quote, mandate, end quote, to confront violence and terrorism, appealing to one side of Egypt's sharply divided populace and raising the specter of broader unrest. And this did, in fact, play out, that there was some broader unrest, and we'll see how far it goes. But basically, as we talked about previously on the show, the issue in this situation in Egypt is that the president, while maybe abusive and not all that democratic, was at least democratically elected, which, if nothing else, indicates that there's a large contingent of people who support him. And in fact, at the time that he was ousted by a coup in early July, it seemed like he still probably even had a majority support. It was at least very close to half, if not more than slightly more than half of the country supporting him. So this becomes a problem for the people who overthrew him, including General Sisi, because, I mean, you don't want to be fighting a majority of the country or having a majority of the country resisting your actions. And the protests have broken out and so on and so forth, and some of them have turned violent. Egyptian security forces have conducted several massacres at this point, or at least police forces have. Several dozen people, 70 people, I think, in one incident and so forth. So this is the path that has Egypt has started to go down. But the thing to remember here is that partly that violence was instigated, and not in the traditional sense where a military leader authorizes a massacre or orders troops to go fire on some crowd or something like that, or just orders them to go, you know, control the situation, then it gets out of hand. A lot of this violence is happening from protesters against protesters, because instead of telling the protesters who led to the government being overthrown to go home, rather this transitional military government has been saying, keep protesting, keep taking to the streets, and show people in Egypt that you want this. And this New York Times article that I was referring to is the most specific incident, where he said he's warning of the dark tunnel that the country could be taken down. And he said, quote, I'm asking you to show the world, if violence is sought or terrorism is sought, the military and police are authorized to confront this. The New York Times describes this as a mass mobilization, a call for mass mobilization, putting the general in the center of Egypt's contentious politics. And he goes from looking like a, you know, in the early parts of July, looking like just your standard, you know, westernized military officer in khakis, you know, with various medals and ribbons on his chest, talking to the TV. Now he's wearing these very elaborate Gaddafi style uniforms, almost. This would be early Gaddafi, not when he started wearing a blanket everywhere. And, you know, a very elaborate hat and sunglasses. I think once we've crossed the sunglasses barrier, we've got a real genuine dictator on our hand. That seems to be their thing these days. Anyway, and he basically was calling for these some observers call, it was a pretty ominous call, saying that they're trying to get the people back in the streets as a way of creating this mandate. Now, again, he nominally at least was not saying, come out and support me, come out and support the military. He was saying, come out and demonstrate in support of what we are doing. Show that show the West, by taking to the streets by the millions, that you are in support of this unelected military-led government, and that we are on the right course right now, and that you support our actions. You support us taking over, you support us continuing to hold power, and you support a crackdown. Because, you know, this is instead of holding some kind of national referendum or something, this is, let's just put a bunch of people in the streets. But of course, it's important to remember that whenever you put, you know, rely on street protests, those are always going to be a minority of a population, or almost always. There's very, very rare cases where you'll actually manage to mobilize a majority of into the streets, in large part because people have jobs and other things that, you know, which is not to say that that's any commentary on protesters or anything. There's lots of legitimate reasons to protest, but it is very difficult to do mass mobilizations. And also a lot of people don't want to, you know, incur the risk that you have to take on by taking to the streets when there could potentially be a violent confrontation, which is obviously very likely in this situation, even if it's not with the military. And so some people were saying, oh, this is a call for civil war. Generally, the Brotherhood people were saying that this was a call for civil war, basically. But the issue that I found so intriguing about this, and there were various other similar articles about this and the aftermath, is this idea of General Sisi calling for mass demonstrations to demonstrate support for a particular policy. That they're, you know, they're not trying to bring down a government or anything like that. That it's, you know, that, and it's not a non-governmental organization or an opposition organization calling for some sort of policy demonstration, as we might see in the United States, where you say, let's all meet on the National Mall in Washington in support of policy XYZ or against policy XYZ. Instead, this is the ruling authorities telling millions of people to take to the streets in support of a specific policy that they would like to enact. And they say, if you get 2 million people in the streets, then we know, even though it's out of 70 million people or whatever, which I think is the population of Egypt, that is a sign that this is what the people want, and this is what the military government should pursue. And that idea, as I said, is intriguing to me in a not very good way, because I'm kind of confused by this notion that, I mean, it's like a street plebiscite, effectively, that you're saying, oh, this is how I'm going to, you know, determine my decisions. Because what if the people don't show up? If you say, oh, well, nobody showed up to protest, does that mean that you don't pursue this policy? And again, it seems to be all instead of having elections or actually following real, genuine democratic processes. There were some photographs that I saw of his face on various posters. So that sort of indicates to me that there may be a little bit of a cult of personality developing here that's tied more directly to him than, you know, that if they're out there demonstrating, it's in support of him and in support of the military, which is already popular, as opposed to in support of these specific policies that he's claiming. But again, his claim is that his call is that he wants people to mobilize in support of this, in support of this policy. It's like this weird framework for generating legitimacy, that X million protesters in the street equals Y points of legitimacy, or Z votes in favor of policy A over policy B. You know, so that's why I call it like kind of like a street plebiscite. And the question is, you know, is this supposed to be a one-time thing? Is he going to keep asking people to take to the streets and say, oh, I'd like to increase healthcare spending by 2.5% in this quarter? If you put 3 million people in the streets in Cairo, then we'll do that. Like, how far does this extend? Do they need to keep on having millions and millions of people show up in the streets to demonstrate renewed support for the military-led government in Egypt? So that's kind of the jumping off point here, where I wanted to get into this and these kind of concepts of legitimacy and, you know, what's a democracy? How do people get to participate in their civil societies? It's like they're provoking incidents to create a support for authoritarian rule as opposed to a need for authoritarian rule, which is what you generally would see in a situation like this, where the military is involved in provoking incidents. That's usually to create a chaotic situation that gives them the popular legitimacy, as we'll be talking about, to intervene. Here, it's rather a situation that they're saying, oh, you should be protesting in support of this continued rule. So Persephone, let's get into this further. What were your thoughts on what I've talked about so far?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's basically the governmental equivalent of, if this post gets 1,000 likes on Facebook, my mom will get me a puppy.
Right.
I mean, it's not very, it's sort of who can shout the loudest. And as we were discussing off air, that's not necessarily the best way to actually evaluate the will of the people. It's just about who can garner the most attention rather than what the majority of the people actually want. And sometimes it may be that it's indicative of the majority will, and that, you know, other people are just, you know, too lazy to go out and protest in agreement. But most of the time, it's just not a very good way to implement policy.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose that, you know, there is a higher participation barrier that you have to go out in the streets and potentially risk violence than just liking something on Facebook. But I do think that is an interesting parallel, this kind of, like, you know, fake self-selecting sample that gets to decide things for seemingly arbitrary reasons, as you know, like the example you give. If you say, oh, if I get 1,000 likes on this, my mom will give me a puppy. I mean, like, what? Like, where is, like, why does the mom have to adhere to, I mean, I guess she agreed to it or something under this hypothetical situation, and then therefore that's the legitimacy of the source of legitimacy for that. But it's, you know, oh, 1,000 random internet people that my mom has never met is now going to determine what my mom, you know, her decision making is or something like that. It'd be even more closely paralleled if the mom was like, well, I don't know if I should get a puppy for my kid, so if I get 1,000 likes, then I'll get a puppy for my kid, and if I don't, then I won't. Like, just very, it's a very capricious way of making decisions, you know. And the other thing that it brought to my mind was kind of that, you know, let's look at some earlier authoritarian examples and this issue of rule of law versus not rule of law, which again, we'll get into, you know, that the 1920s fascists, the 1930s Nazis were all about this idea that, you know, you would create chaos, and that would create a state of emergency. And that was kind of the famous Nazi theorist and political scientist who is one of the few Nazis that anyone actually still cites anymore, Carl Schmitt. He basically came up with this. And again, this is this issue of, are you a philosopher advocating for something or just describing something? And that's one of the reasons he's still cited, is because in addition to advocating for various horrible Nazi ideas, he also was someone who just described, you know, various types of government, and that is still valuable, even if the Nazis were terrible. You know, and his notion was this idea of a permanent state of emergency, the state of exception. And he, of course, in addition to describing that, he was advocating that. He thought that the government should create a condition for the permanent state of emergency, because democracy and other systems like that are inefficient, inherently inefficient, and the only way to cut through the waste and the bureaucracy and everything was to create a state of emergency where a single leader is empowered to make these decisions. But, you know, that helps describe the situation, but then you get into his advocacy thing, whereas he was advocating something like the government should create the necessary conditions for this, you know, foster chaos, go randomly start murdering people in the night and things like that. That creates this panic and so on and so forth. That was sort of Mussolini's whole idea, was this, like, you know, if we just go and have people, thugs beating up people, then that creates the conditions for our own intervention, even if we're the same people causing the problem. And, you know, the situation here is the opposite, which is why I distinguish between incidents in support of authoritarian rule versus incidents justifying authoritarian rule. And kind of another parallel to think of here that brings in the Schmitt example is that the Nazis kind of are believed to have, if not orchestrated, definitely taken advantage of the burning of the Reichstag, which was the German parliament. And that was when they established the state of emergency, which they then extended repeatedly throughout the 1930s and into World War II and all the way till the fall of the Nazi regime. This would be like, instead of saying, well, because the Reichstag was burned, we're going to have authoritarian rule, this would be like getting up and giving a speech and telling the people of Egypt to burn down the parliament building to show their support for not having a parliament, and that this is somehow supposed to be a demonstration that this is what the people want, you know, as opposed to this is an incident of arson. So let's get into that this legitimacy issue, which we've kind of been towing around this whole time. This notion of where do people get their authority to rule, might or legitimacy, and what are the different types of legitimacy? So I'm going to hand it off to Persephone here to kind of give us the background on this.
Well, let's, you know, go back for a minute to the 1600s to look at John Locke's work. Now, Locke, of course, is very well known for his emphasis on property, but what's interesting about his arguments about the natural right to property is that he believed that entering the political system means withdrawing your right to property in certain situations and letting the community deal with it. So this isn't directly relevant to legitimacy, except that he then goes on to explain that these individuals who decide that in their own interests, to protect their own interests, they need to create a government, are consenting to the rule of that government. And he specifies that if you agree to a government, then whatever the government does, as long as it does not cross certain lines, you have to accept. So if the majority decides on something that you don't like, you can't then say, well, I'm not going to be part of this anymore, because you had originally said that you were going to participate in it. And if every time that somebody votes on something you don't like and wins, people withdraw, then that kind of defeats the entire purpose of the government.
Right. The idea being that you wouldn't get together and form a society and a system of governance if you could just leave every time the rest of the society did something you didn't like. Now, obviously, later philosophers incorporated, John Stuart Mill and folks like that incorporated ideas of protecting minority rights, which becomes very important. I mean, it should have been important, but obviously didn't become important for a lot of folks until much later. And that's more, late 20th century, post-World War II type of thing. And we can certainly see that folks who were opposing the government in Egypt were claiming that their rights had been infringed. And at a certain point, it's kind of a fuzzy line of, well, is this tyranny or is this just, I don't like these particular decisions? Is it infringing my rights or is it just I'm unhappy with it? Which is sort of the whole problem with the Tea Party movement, is this kind of notion that they don't like certain policies and claim that their fundamental freedoms are being infringed. But it's a pretty dubious argument to make. And I think that was kind of John Locke's point, as you were saying, which is that, at a certain point, you have to just accept that sometimes there are going to be decisions made by the majority of the society that you've agreed to be a part of that you don't particularly like, but you do have to adhere to them because that's what the rest of society decided. And you established society so that you would have freedom from being killed by your neighbors, freedom from external forces coming in and killing you or stealing your stuff, things like that, that you've gotten together and formed a society so that you can have certain benefits. And you don't get to keep those benefits if you just try to, pull a Kentucky and nullify something that the rest of the country passed and just leave. Or you can leave. You can physically get up and leave the country. But if you're going to stay, you have to agree to be part of the society and you can't pick and choose what you want to follow.
Right. As I said before, there are certain conditions that do apply and that would make the dissolution of a government legitimate. So I think some of those things for Locke included messing around with the parliament. Well, he didn't use the term parliament, but he said that if the legislative branch is altered or the executive neglects or abandons its charge, or when the legislative branch or the what he calls prince act contrary to their trust, to their role in the system, then there is an argument for the dissolution of government. So I guess in this case, we could look at what exactly led to these protests and what were the main points and whether they fit with sort of Locke's ideas about this.
Right, because you could make the argument that the government lacked a legislative branch, that it was suspended and nullified after elections, and it was just a president, and therefore this was tampering with the legislative system in this transition that was being undertaken, although, again, they hadn't formalized everything, so it seems a little bit shaky one way or the other. But the key thing to remember there is who suspended it. It wasn't President Morsi, who was the one who got overthrown, and people are saying, oh, but he didn't have a legislature. Yeah, he didn't have a legislature because his party won the election for the legislature, and the military and the military-backed judicial branch didn't like that, so they said that the legislature had been unconstitutionally put together or elected or whatever. So you know, it's a little bit flimsy in my mind to say that it was legitimate to overthrow President Morsi because of tampering with the legislative branch when the people who overthrew him are the ones who took away the legislature.
It actually fits surprisingly well with your burning down the parliament example. I also think that, you know, while there perhaps was an argument in the initial dissatisfaction with Morsi because of his seizing of executive power, I think it was for, you know, the emergency situation. Well, his initial extension of his own power, it could be argued that that was a sort of neglect or a change in his charge. But then he rescinded that, and the most recent protests were about, you know, were about economic dissatisfaction, and also, you know, legitimate social dissatisfaction on social issues that
right.
are important.
And there's plenty of people being upset about social issues and the fact that they're unemployed and don't have enough to eat in a lot of cases. But again, that's not necessarily like tyranny. That's just Egypt has severe economic problems that is going to be true for anyone.
Right. So I think that that certainly under Locke, we can't really find an argument in support of the military's actions.
And what about in terms of this idea of these street plebiscites of massing a certain number of people in the street in support of various policies? I think we probably have to look more into depth on the legitimacy issues under Weber to get into that, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, just to fill everybody in, so Weber had these sort of three sources of authority, which were legal authority, traditional authority, and charismatic authority. So legal authority is pretty straightforward. It's the idea that authority is derived from a series of legal rules, a legal system.
And this goes back to Locke's concept of a civil society, which is where everyone gets together and they say, okay, we don't want to just be in anarchy. We don't want our property and our lives at risk, etc. Let's get together, establish a known set of rules. Everyone has to follow them. They all get applied uniformly. You know, if you break them, there's a system for punishing infractions. There's also a system for appealing such punishments. These are, again, things that aren't found in, say, a monarchy, an absolute monarchy, at least. And that, you know, that everyone retains the right to self-defense, collective self-defense, at least, against external threats to life, liberty, and what he called a state. This was his concept of a civil society. And this is this concept that you hear about a lot, rule of law, the application of rule of law. And again, they were in the middle of a transition process in Egypt. That makes it a little bit shaky either way. You can, you know, say, oh, well, they didn't, you know, they're still in flux. Or were they applying the rules properly? Were the transitional guidelines being followed? What's the authority for the transition? That kind of thing. You can have that discussion, certainly. But, you know, at minimum, you got to follow the set of procedures, and overthrowing the president who's been elected under the procedures for electing a president, that's not really following the rules that the legal system that Weber is talking about, where the legitimacy is derived from following these established and uniformly applied rules that Locke talked about.
Yeah. And the other two grounds for authority, I don't think are necessarily extremely relevant.
But I think it's good here to talk about them so that people understand kind of the different categories.
Right. Yeah. So traditional grounds rest on this belief of the sanctity of traditions. So, you know, one example would be my father gave me this branch, you know, and he told me to do this and this and this with it because that's how we've done it in our family for the past 100 years.
Right. I mean, that would certainly be the, you know, kind of like colloquial interpersonal example or something like that of this idea that this is how it's always been done. But you can really scale that up because it's not just like, it's one thing for people to say, oh, this is how my family has always done it. It's another thing if your family is the royal family. And, you know, in some country, and you say, you know, and you get the entire nation to collectively agree that they're going to continue to have a king, and that the king is going to continue to be the source of authority because this is how it's always been done. I mean, that's one reason why England never formally got a constitution together. The United States has a written constitution. Most countries do. The English constitution, such as it exists, was something that one guy came up with just on his own based on all these traditions and things of how things had typically run. And he put it together in a book, but it's not like an official document or anything in the way that the U.S. constitution is. It's, you know, the English constitution is sort of more of an abstract concept that is like, this is how it's always been done, or at minimum, this is how it evolved from how it's always been done. Because, of course, there's been an evolution away from absolute monarchy and toward having an elected parliament that increasingly had more power and represented more people directly. But at the end of the day, the, you know, sort of traditional thing that can be either a religious based concept, either, you know, a mandate of heaven, or saying that God has ordained that this royal family continue to rule over England or France or something like that. But that, you know, obviously that doesn't apply in a situation like we're talking about with Egypt, because this is a new government. The military is not, you know, I mean, sure, traditionally in the past 60, 70 years, this is how it's been done. But, you know, before that, there were monarchies that were relatively new and kind of just arbitrary as well throughout the region. Like the Saudi Arabian monarchy, it's not like that goes back for many, many centuries or something. That was set up in the 1700s. So there are certain cases where people just kind of accept it, like paper money or something. They say, this is what we are collectively all going to agree is the way that it works, is that this, you know, this, we've always had a king, so we're going to continue to have a king, and we're all going to agree that this is the, you know, XYZ powers are reserved to the king. So that's Weber's concept of the traditional legitimacy. So let's talk about the third one now.
Yeah, so the third, you know, source of authority is, it's charismatic authority. And this one is a little bit weird, but you can kind of understand it if you think at, you know, think back to, you know, all the cults of personality that we've had over time. The idea is that, you know, certain figures, for no reason other than their pure charismatic energy, have authority because, you know, they can generate energy from people. They can get people enthusiastic about something.
Yeah. And certainly a lot of them also rely on military power or something like that. But the idea here is that if, you know, if they had to rely purely on military authority, that would be might, not legitimacy, and charisma would have nothing to do with it. I mean, maybe it would help them keep control of the military or something like that. But this idea of a charismatic legitimacy is basically like, you know, the fact that Stalin, say, during, you know, during peacetime, well, the fact that there was peacetime says a lot. I mean, when he wasn't involved in World War II, the fact that he wasn't actively being overthrown at all times, and the fact that he wasn't, you know, consistently having to be committing mass murders or something. He certainly did mass murder a lot of people, but a lot of that he actually did, unlike, say, the Nazis, he did it by things like mass starvation or mass deportation and things like that. He wasn't necessarily having to say, okay, I'm gonna have to deploy this division of my military to the such and such area because there's some uprising or something. You know, if you have a country, you know, or you could probably use the example of Mao, who's another great cult of personality example. He certainly did use the military in various places domestically. And the Chinese government has been known to put down insurrections with military force, but it's not like the entire time Mao was in power, he was only in power because his military was actively shooting people or something like that, or that there was this, you know, threat at all times that you could be instantly killed or something like that. Certainly helps, but, you know, but a lot of that kind of strength and power was derived not so much from the military force, but from the fact that people respected and loved this leader and, you know, were obsessed with him and that sort of thing.
And were willing to overlook his flaws.
Right. We're willing to, you know, we're willing to overlook the fact that he had, you know, just kind of arbitrarily come to power through a revolution or something like that. You know, or in Stalin's case, basically murdering everyone in the senior leadership of the Communist Party. That, you know, and of course they do a lot to foster this, but that has been a key source of non-rule of law legitimacy that's alternative to these traditional forms. It's a lot newer. So certainly when General Sisi starts putting on the sunglasses and getting people to, you know, have posters in support of him with his face on it, you know, Gaddafi style, of course, Gaddafi being one of the absolute kings of the cult of personality model, that certainly is leaning toward that cult of personality example. But I still think that, you know, this idea of calling for protests is a very interesting one, because it doesn't really fall neatly into any of those boxes. And, you know, again, it seems like it's trending toward the cult of personality, so it may just end up working out that that's what, you know, it's the charismatic leadership type model of legitimacy that ends up being followed. And arguably, that's what the military has already in Egypt. They're popular, so the military collectively has this legitimacy because they are popular and charismatic to some extent and hold a certain place in people's hearts, if not in their legal system.
So what about a traditional ground for this? I mean, is there a way to argue that even though it's not a, you know, very well-established tradition, that we have been seeing a series of uprisings, you know, just in general, you know, the Arab Spring, it's a tradition, you know, that has been developed in other countries and has been sort of spreading across, and that this is just a sort of continuation of this idea of the popular uprising as a way to establish a new government?
I think probably the better example that we want to look at is the fact that Nasser came from the military, Sadat came from the military, Mubarak came from the military, Tantawi came from the military, Morsi did not, that was the big exception, and now Sisi is back and he's from the military. And again, they, you know, put in civilian leadership or whatever, but so what? They all put in civilian leadership at some point usually, because these military dictators generally recognize that they have to have at least some civilian people around them, because they don't know everything about how to run various agencies or provide services, and if they don't do that, eventually they get overthrown. But I alluded to that earlier about this idea that they replaced a pretty flimsy monarchy with a military-based system. And so, yeah, you could argue that they have this tradition that the leader of the military in Egypt gets to be the leader of the country, or that a charismatic figure from the military or retired figure from the military gets to be the leader of the country, things like that. And there's certainly, you know, other examples from across the Middle East of doing this, and probably is even more of an example than your Arab Spring point. But I think that's not the argument being made there, because he hasn't put himself directly in power, and he is, you know, and it wasn't just a demonstration in support of the military broadly or this junta's rule. He's calling specifically for these protests in support of the military cracking down on quote-unquote terrorists.
Well, right, but it's this emphasis on the protests. I mean, he technically does not need these protests to allow him to seize power. He could just, you know,
right, because he has the military.
Right, so this emphasis on having this public support, I mean, I think it definitely is a move to gain himself legitimacy. And I think he's deriving it from this, you know, that the previous way, the most recent way that power was established was with popular uprisings.
Yeah, well, and I suspect that part of the motivation he has here is that if he can mobilize millions of people in the streets in support of a military crackdown or something like that, then at minimum that gives Western media pause to say, well, he is cracking down, yes, but to be fair, he did get millions of people into the streets saying that he wanted to do this. And that pause, that hesitance to say, well, this is this brutal military regime that's, you know, not supported or something like that, because it can be a brutal military regime that is very popular and very well supported. If you give the Western media that momentary pause, that's enough hesitation to allow Washington to continue this kind of baloney thing that we talked about on a previous episode of refusing to call it a military coup, because they're still working toward a transition after overthrowing the previous transition. And you can say, you know, instead of having mass public support in the United States for cutting off military aid to Egypt, which Washington is very reluctant to do, and the Egyptian military is very reluctant to have happen, they can say, okay, well, there is some popular support, so let's just kind of see how this plays out, and we'll kick this down the road and decide later what we want to do here. So arguably, it's not, you know, yeah, he doesn't need more legitimacy generated within Egypt. This is sort of generating legitimacy overseas in the media. You know, and I don't know what category that falls into. I think Weber maybe didn't anticipate transnational media manipulation or whatever as a tool for remaining in power, certainly. So, you know, that's kind of where I am on that. And I did think there was an interesting thing from Locke about that absolute rulers may try to protect their citizenry and keep the peace, but they only do it because it preserves their power and maintains their workforce. And this idea that you know, Egyptians should be wary about trusting a government like this, because at the end of the day, they're not really trying to help you. They're just trying to help preserve their business interests and their economic interests and make sure that they don't lose any of those by getting them taken away by some external force, whether it's a U.S. aid cutoff or by getting literally overthrown by the people or something like that. And, you know, ultimately, if the ruler, and we saw this in the very limited transition period where the military had direct control after Mubarak, and I don't, you know, it's amazing that Egyptians managed to forget so quickly. It took them like a year and a half, maybe a year, to forget that this had happened. And no one is going to protect the citizens from the ruler if the ruler becomes the problem. And in this case, they were intervening purportedly because, you know, the people had demanded protection from their existing leader, and this is the external force or the internal force, however you want to categorize it, that can, you know, protect them. But now those people are in charge again, and when they become the problem, there's no one to protect you anymore. Locke said, quote, "Men are so foolish that they take care to avoid what mischiefs may be done them by polecats or foxes, but are content, nay, think it safety, to be devoured by lions." All right, well, that was a pretty good discussion. We'll be right back here on Arsenal for Democracy in just a moment. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, co-host Persephone.
Hey there.
All right. Well, the next story that I wanted to talk about was the front page story on the Boston Globe this morning. It was called "A Rising Tide of Concern. Business is booming from end to end of the city's waterfront, but the specter of surging sea levels has developers on edge." Now, Persephone had actually alluded to this problem becoming an increasing issue several weeks back on the show. You know, that cities like Boston are in fact concerned about rising tides from global warming. Whether or not people in the interior heartland want to admit that this is a problem, it is in fact a problem. And there, you know, I thought it was fantastic, first of all, that the Boston Globe had a homegrown piece on this issue that they put on the front page, because it really is of critical importance. And basically what happened was that the Hurricane Sandy put a lot of it into perspective for a lot of folks on the East Coast, New York, and New England areas in particular, because of how Long Island and New York City were hit so badly by the storm surges. Now, again, there is a distinction between rising tides that are permanently rising and are not, you know, a brief one-time thing versus hurricanes. And, you know, some guy got mad at me on Twitter last fall during Hurricane Sandy when I posted a picture of water pouring in over some of the shallower areas in lower Manhattan. And he was like, well, you know, it's not global warming, because I made some allusion to that. And I said, this is what it would look like if, you know, global warming causes the tides to rise as has been expected and is starting to happen. And I was like, well, yeah, This is a picture of her, of a hurricane doing that, sure. But there's two things to remember here. One, this is what it would look like, which is what I said. You know, if instead of a hurricane, if instead it was tides rising, and this is, you know, this would be where it would permanently be flooding. But the other thing to remember is that hurricanes, not only are there more of them and of higher intensity with global warming, but it's worth remembering, and this is the critical point that's raised throughout this article in the Boston Globe, is that the storm surges from hurricanes are worse because of higher tides. The impact is significantly greater. So they were saying, for example, they were citing various figures of the enormous amounts of water that ended up flooding a lot of areas in lower Manhattan and as a result of Hurricane Sandy. Those are the ones that we saw the pictures of, and they had to do a lot of pumping out, and there was $50 billion worth of damage in New York City. But a lot of, there's a lot of close ties between Boston and New York City, you know, big corporate real estate people, the finance industry, that kind of thing. A lot of these people know each other, talk to each other about this. And they were saying, here's the thing. If that had gone slightly further east and hit Boston, which was originally a possibility, instead of hitting New York, that would have caused a substantial amount of damage. And they said in this article that 6% of Boston would be underwater from the storm surge. Not permanently, of course, but that's a huge economic impact that would have shut down a lot of the city for weeks. I mean, it would have been way worse in many ways than the shutdown from the Marathon bombing. And it, you know, it takes significant pumping, permanent water damage, a lot of renovations would have to be done, etc. But this is even more of a concern for Boston than it is for New York City, for many of the same reasons that a lot of these other areas that have been hit in the past have been concerns, is this issue of elevation and kind of what land is there. Boston in particular, very low-lying, but more importantly, built on a lot of filled-in areas. Folks who are from Boston are generally pretty aware of that. It's something that does come up, you know, fairly often, so we're at least like culturally aware that there's a lot of fill, even if people don't think about it very much. You hear about like Deer Island is not actually an island anymore because there's been a fill section added to connect it. That's true of areas all around Boston Harbor. There's just an enormous amount of fill that's been put in, and that is inherently unstable and, more importantly, inherently very low-lying. So it's certainly not Rotterdam, which is like 20 feet below sea level or something like that, but it is very susceptible to flooding. And a lot of the emphasis in the past several decades in terms of rejuvenating Boston and improving the city and you know, strengthening it after some of the urban decline issues that most American cities faced, especially in the Northeast, the emphasis was getting these commercial and financial districts and stuff built pretty close to the waterfront. And so the areas that would be most affected by some of this flooding, whether it's general tidal rises or storm surges from, you know, a hurricane like Hurricane Sandy, if it were to hit Boston, that these are the areas that are going to be most heavily impacted. And that's, as I said, some commercial stuff, some financial stuff, and even governmental stuff. Government Center would be one of the areas that would be partially flooded out pretty easily by water coming in pretty far.
Now, not that anyone would miss the City Hall.
Yeah, City Hall is pretty ugly for those who don't know what Boston City Hall looks like. But the, you know, the storm surge is probably the biggest risk in terms of flooding a certain area of the city, because that is where it would get the farthest into the city. And they said in this article that if the tides were 2.5 feet higher as a, you know, a regular point, and a hurricane hit at high tide of the same intensity as Hurricane Sandy, that would end up flooding not 6% of the city, which is what it would be now, but it would flood 30% of the city, which is just truly staggering. And again, Boston's not that big of a city in terms of the actual downtown and the population. 30% of the city would be temporarily underwater. Just massively, almost incalculable damage that I can think of right there. And that becomes a pretty serious problem, of course, on its face. But the other point that is raised is that in addition to the storm surges, you get the issue of just having the water higher in general. And a lot of these areas, as I said, very low-lying, which means that if the tides go up, as has been happening very rapidly on the East Coast, apparently the eastern seaboard of the United States, I'm guessing, has pretty low-lying shallow kind of coastal shelves and beaches for the most part up and down the U.S. East Coast, that means that the tides come up a higher height at a faster rate than they would on, say, a steeper coast. And that means that a larger geographical area ends up underwater. And they were they have various maps in this article showing how flooded out some of these pretty big landmarks are. Ironically, the New England Aquarium would be flooded out, which I found kind of amusing, although it's not really. But just in terms of the irony, it's pretty funny. And, you know, that water would go in pretty deeply up the Boston waterfront area if the tides rise, you know, 5 feet or something like that in terms of where the high tide is. Again, if you haven't been down to the New England Aquarium, if you go look there, like most of the time, you're maybe 5 feet above the water, maybe 4 feet in some cases. And that's certainly fine most of the time, but even when it's not a hurricane condition, if the high tide ends up permanently being 5 feet higher than it is, I mean, you can say, oh, well, let's just build higher walls or something like that. But that's a pretty big investment and it tends not to work. You know, if you actually study, I took a class at one point. It was a pretty great class. Well, taking a number of classes related to water stuff, but there was in particular, there was this sort of geology class that I was taking. And it was there was a whole unit on some of these issues like, you know, river changes, tidal changes, and that sort of thing. And areas where they've tried to do manipulations of beaches or, you know, build higher seawalls or things like that, whether it's in Florida, New Orleans, North Carolina, places like that. Generally, it's either a very temporary fix that ends up not working very much in the long run, or it consistently has to be renewed, or it's been a complete failure. And that's kind of the risk that you run. There's very limited things you can do for a permanent fix. And it is also, it's pretty worrying, kind of like, you know, the probably apocryphal story of the boy, you know, the Dutch boy putting his fingers in the dikes to keep the water from flooding out the country or whatever. Obviously, I think that never actually really happened. But this idea that if the only thing, and this has happened in New Orleans, if the only thing that's keeping the water out of your major city areas is by building walls up around yourself along the waterfront, that is a very serious risk to be taking. And that means that anytime there's a storm surge or one of those components fails or something like that, you've now got a huge wall of water bearing down on your downtown area. That's a pretty serious problem. So I, you know, definitely we need to be keeping our eye on the situation in Boston and actually taking it seriously, as these folks who are actually affected are taking it seriously. Well, we had other stories we were hoping to cover, but unfortunately that is all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for August 4th, 2013. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts every week, usually on Sundays, and is available for download from billhumphreyresearch.com/radio on Monday nights or Tuesday mornings. You can also hear a repeat of it on 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in Delaware, or at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin, and my co-host, Persephone. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.